You're listening to Culture with Robert Bound, first broadcast on January the 6th, 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 117th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. A year has passed since we last gathered a troop of cultural stalwarts around this very table to take a look ahead at what 2013 might be offering. And 365 days later, we're back to assess what became of our predictions and gaze into our crystal ball for the year ahead. And again, I'm not alone. In front of me is Jason Wood, Director of Programming at Curzon Cinemas, and he returns to bring us his picks for 2014.
This is a film which, by looking back, it looks forward as well in the same way. And the period production details in this film are absolutely spot on, but it could really take place now.
To my right, Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, joins us once again to talk us through some of the best TV the world has to offer in the year ahead.
This second series is going to be really interesting. I think there's going to be quite a noise around it because it's really shrouded in secrecy.
And to my left, Simon Prosser, publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, a new addition to this year's lineup, who's been scouring the literary landscape to help us decide which books to stack up ready for reading in 2014.
It's very interesting to me the number of writers I know who have been either writing for or pitching for doing HBO series, especially HBO.
Yeah.
That seems to be the holy grail.
And I'm back here, of course, again to chair proceedings, play some musical recommendations for the coming months and throw in a gag or two. That's what it says in the script. On this, our January look ahead, it's Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Well, welcome, gang. Faces new and old. I don't mean old, I mean new and fresh. I mean fresh and you know what I mean. We've rejigged it slightly for 2014. We're going to be talking about film and television and books this time. I hope we can allude maybe to our Christmas period. We can do that. We can fudge that, can't we? But really, we've asked you back to look into your crystal balls. One thing I wanted to do to get us into the mood, maybe while we pour a drink, is to play you a couple of tracks throughout the show as well to break us up, get us in the mood. This is something new from an Israeli artist called Asaf Avidan. I think he's going to be big in 2014. This is Different Pulses.
My life is like a
And that is upcoming from Asaf Avidan from Israel. The track is called Different Pulses. He'll be coming out with a debut album in 2014. We were kind of swooning along to that, weren't we, crew? It was kind of... What did it remind us of? What did it put us in mind of?
Jimmy Scott.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
You were saying that when we were listening to the track. It does have that. You were saying that sort of androgynous...
Yeah, sort of genderless
quality to it. But it takes you on a trip, that.
Mm, that's lovely.
So we want to... And they'll be chucking a couple more suggestions in. I think we're going to have to swap a list of stuff. As much as it's meant to be written down in front of us, we're meant to be recommending stuff to each other and to our listeners, we also need to have a short list. Jason, we're going to come to you first for our 2014 look ahead. We're going into the world of films. Jason Wood is programming director of Curzon Cinemas. And last year around this table, Jason, you rated Spring Breakers. I just want to remind our listeners of exactly how you rated it.
I've never been a big fan of Harmony Korine's filmmaking. I think it's kind of provocative in a very kind of self-conscious way. Yeah. And I saw Spring Breakers at the Toronto Film Festival with very, very low expectations. And I thought it was absolutely terrific. I mean, the best way to describe it, it's kind of like a 90-minute version of the video promo for Aphex Twin's Window Licker.
Did you like being bracketed by a sort of dreamy harp sound effect?
Yeah, so I always imagine myself bracketed by a dreamy harp. Unfortunately, nobody went to see Spring Breakers, so let's hope I do better this year. It's one of those films that really divided people. I remember kind of broadsheet press were horrified by it. I still think it stands up brilliantly. I still think it's a terrific
I thought it was
film.
A great movie. I thought it was sexy. I thought it was exciting. I thought it looked great. And you're right. I mean, it was a super splashy thing, but with a genuine sort of heart.
Yeah.
I wonder if Lisa or Simon have seen it. Did either of you catch Spring Breakers?
I just got the DVD that someone's... But I was the same. I read the broadsheets reviews and I thought, no way am I going to see that.
That's your broadsheet reading voice.
Yes. I will actually. You reminded me, your review of last year's, I'm gonna get that DVD out when I get home.
Watch it in a bikini. That's okay. The best way to...
I always watch films in bikini.
Me too.
That's why I turned out the heating in this studio. It never works.
Like I've seen it.
Right, because you've heard so much about it.
I've heard so much about it, but so many good things about it, actually. And in a way, I don't want to see it because it might ruin it. But now you've explained so well how good it is, I think I will see it.
It gets worse from here on in when I describe things.
Spring Breakers was a tip. Maybe a critical rather than a box office tip for 2013. Yeah. And it was a great movie. James Franco ate the screen, didn't he? It was a pretty decent turn. Yeah. So what about 2014? We've got a little list of things that you wanted to tell us about. Jason, where are we going to start?
Well, we're going to start with Inside Llewelyn Davis, which is the new film from the Coen brothers. And I'm a really big fan of the Coen brothers. I was talking to somebody else about this today, and I think of all the filmmakers, American or otherwise, I think in a career which goes back to, I think, 1986 or so with their first film, Blood Simple, I think they've made very few duds. Their last film was a more mainstream studio picture, True Grit, the remake, the John Wayne movie with Jeff Bridges in the central role. But this new film is one of their smaller scale pictures. It's from an original screenplay. It's about the kind of 1960s folk scene in Greenwich Village in New York. It has affiliations with Bob Dylan. It's about a struggling folk singer who's kind of lost direction in his life.
He's a fictional character. It's a written thing, yeah.
Yeah, and if you look at most of the Coen brothers films, they're normally about people, nominally men, who are somehow searching for direction in life. And in this instance, in Inside Llewelyn Davis, it's a folk singer played by Oscar Isaac, who most people will remember from Drive. Hopefully they'll have forgotten him from the terrible atrocity that was W.E., the Madonna film. And Oscar Isaac really is brilliant. I mean, people are always talking about the film that makes you a star. I think this probably will achieve it with Oscar Isaac. It's got a melancholia to it. And I always like melancholia in cinema and in anything, actually. But I think with the Coen brothers, there's also a populism there. And I think this is a film which people will go and see.
No, you don't want to go anywhere. And that's why all the same shit is going to keep happening to you, because you want it to.
Is that why?
Yes, and also because you're an asshole.
Be the coast of California.
So it's fairly well.
What'd you say you played?
Folk songs.
Folk songs. I thought you said you were a musician.
Another day, another time. It ain't believing.
Folk singer with a cat.
It's not my cat, I just didn't know what to do with it.
Really? So, did you bring your dick along too?
That was a clip from Inside Llewellyn Davis, upcoming from the Coen Brothers. Always nice to get a clip that's 20 seconds long with three swear words in. I think that's...
Can't do better than that.
That's always great. Listeners are going to love that, you see. Having only watched the trailer but read around the film a bit, I wonder if it picks up on any themes, any current themes in American cinema. I was going to ask you, Jason, about looking forward, whether there is an idea of America still, through its cinema, looking back to assess where it is at the moment. I mean, there's not... I mean, obviously, there's a sort of a folk rock revival, maybe, but I wonder where this kind of fits in, whether this has been on the slate for the Coen Brothers for a while and now it's finally being made, or whether it's something that needs to be made now.
I think with the Coen Brothers, they're a bit like Woody Allen. They're always thinking ahead to the next film. And this film is obviously set in the kind of pre-Vietnam climate. And this idea of people looking for themselves, there's a lot of characters in this film, or there's one central character in this film who's about to go off to war. So it is about an America which is somehow slightly lost. Now, obviously, that was the situation in the 1960s, but I think it's also very much the situation now, not just in America. I think if you look at cultures across the world, they're kind of looking for where they are and where they want to be. And this is a film which, by looking back, it looks forward as well in the same way. And the fact that it's set in the 1960s really, and the period production details in this film are absolutely spot on, but it could really take place now. And I think it would still have a similar momentum. It isn't just about men, it's about relationships between men and women. Again, it's another recurring theme of the Coen Brothers. It's about men screw up these relationships and are kind of feckless and foolish and stupid and immature.
So is it less of a musical and more of a character film? So
absolutely.
Yeah,
it's a character film. And as I said, I always relate to characters. I don't know what it says about me. You're kind of lost. And he's a bit of a loser. He's a very charming loser.
But do they fall into that cliche where, you know, you have the sort of tortured artist and then amazing performer? Is it?
Yeah, no, because the guy in it is a bit of a buffoon. I mean, he kind of uses what little skills he has as a tactic to sleep with women. I mean, you know, the thing with the Coen Brothers films is even their most serious works. I mean, Blood Simple, which for me is still one of the greatest modern American pictures and one of the greatest modern American film noirs. It's a very dark... I don't know how many of you have seen it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really, really dark film, but it's punctured with these moments of complete black humour. And I think that's the thing that always saves Coen Brothers films from pomposity. If you think of Fargo, another very blackly comic film, they almost kind of prick their own seriousness with these kind of comic interludes. And inside Llewellyn Davis, we heard John Goodman mention it. There's this great cat that runs all the way through it. And part of the film is the central character's search for this cat. And, you know, he takes it on the tube and it isn't even his cat. And it is just very funny, but it's funny in a way which is gently humorous rather than Farrelly Brothers laugh out loud, cross-gender, fat people comedy.
Let's talk about Under the Skin, Jason. New from Jonathan Glazer. This is kind of split, at least the online community, we might call them. This has really split people down the middle, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it split people when it played originally in Venice last year. There was a lot of walkouts. I sometimes judge a film by how successful it is, by how many people don't like it. And this was a film that a lot of people didn't like. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think this is one of the best films by a British director I've seen in a long, long time. I mean, Jonathan Glazer kind of announced himself with A Sexy Beast, Ben Kingsley and Ray Winstone film. Then he made Birth, which I was slightly less enamoured by. But Under the Skin is just something else completely. It's from a book by Michael Faber, I think, which is about, in terms of a rough...
And you're wondering if that was one of Simon's books?
It's not.
It's not.
It's not, but it's a book I think it's a fantastic book.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Again, you know, with the Coen Brothers film, this is very, very different to the book. The brief synopsis is about an alien that lands in Scotland and that goes in search of men to seduce and bring back to this kind of very, very strange building where they're wrapped in this viscous liquid and stored away for what we don't know. And the book is much more in-depth in terms of how it explains things, whereas the film is much more impressionistic.
Hi. Yeah, of course.
You
become pretty.
I am gorgeous.
Do you?
I definitely am.
You don't want to wake up, do you?
That sort of soaring music kind of reminds me of Warren Ellis's work with Nick Cave for some of those sort of proto-westerns that they've written. That's really sending a chill down my spine, actually. It's reminding me of some scenes from that movie.
Well, it's an incredibly singular film. As I said, one of the upsides and one of the downsides of my job is I see films amongst a whole cavalcade of other films. So for something to stand out, it has to be impressive. And I just thought this on every level, a technical level. The music, as you mentioned, is brilliant. Scarlett Johansson is just unbelievable in this role. I mean, she plays somebody who obviously it has an English accent. And a lot of this film was filmed on the streets of Scotland. And it reminds me of Godard's film Alphaville. It's set in very humdrum everyday locations, but they somehow could be anywhere. It could be out of space. And when they were filming, they didn't always get permission to film. It's filmed very much on the hoof, on the streets. And there are moments where Scarlett Johansson walks into people. There's a moment where she comes out of a nightclub and a load of drunk women accost her. And that's all kind of filmed for real. It wasn't actors playing those parts. But it also has a... It's completely terrifying. And these sequences where these hapless men who are all seduced by the idea of going to bed with Scarlett Johansson, or the Scarlett Johansson character, are lured back to this building, and they're kind of drawn into this pool of dark, viscous liquid where they're just left to kind of hang. And I don't know, most of you will be familiar with the work of the video artist Bill Viola. Mm. And I think he made a piece of work called Returning, where a figure in a tank just kind of floats from the bottom to the top. And this really reminded me of that. And when I came back from Toronto, I actually flew back with the director. Very embarrassing. I had no idea that this was the director of the film. And luckily, he asked me what films I'd seen and liked. And I talked about Under the Skin very evangelically, having no idea I was talking to the director. And at the end, you know, he did kind of say, I'm pleased you liked it because I made it.
Is it very stylized and artsy? Because, you know, he's from a commercials background, isn't he? And you know, I've interviewed him in the past. He always sort of prided himself on, you know, innovating and getting some great new techniques. And is any of that in the film?
It is. I mean, it is incredibly stylized. You're absolutely right. But not in a way...
It's not slick, is it? It's not high. It doesn't seem like it has high production values in a sense. It just is very considered.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite grim and grimy. And it's all set in winter. And it's all set in... I mean, I'm imagining it's one of the major Scottish cities, but it's kind of the outskirts of the city. So all the nightclubs they film in and the pubs are din and dirty. And I mean, the film is kind of about sex and about the male obsession with sex. And you get this idea, you know, the kind of the stench and the depravity and the kind of moral degradation that we kind of sink to. I mean, it's a film which kind of lays bare the baser aspects of humanity. I mean, drunk, pissed up people just wanting to have a good time to get away from the grimness of their lives.
We've got 1 minute, Jason, just to tell us why The Double and All Is By My Side are worth consideration as well.
Well, I'll start with All Is By My Side. All Is By My Side, I'm afraid, is another film I saw in Toronto as I did The Double. All Is By My Side is the first film by John Ridley, who's the screenwriter for Steve McQueen. Mm-hmm. John Ridley wrote 12 Years a Slave. And All Is By My Side is a kind of impressionistic portrait of the years that Jimi Hendrix lived in London before he became a massive star following his performance at the American Festival. It reminds me a lot of a film made by British filmmaker Christopher Monk called The Hours and the Times, which is about a weekend that John Lennon apparently spent in Barcelona with Brian Epstein. All Is By My Side is a kind of anti-biopic. People that go along wanting to learn about Jimi Hendrix probably won't learn that much. The Jimi Hendrix role is played by Andre 3000 from Outkast, and I think he's absolutely brilliant. I think this is a brilliant, brilliant British film, and it really stakes John Ridley's claim not only as a great screenwriter, but also as a great director in his own right. Very, very quickly, The Double is the second film by Richard Ayoade, who made Submarine, and many of your listeners will know from the IT
Crowd. It's a charming movie, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The Double's great. It's adapted... Yeah, I mean, and this, I think, really builds upon it. It's a really, really brave film because people going expecting Submarine 2 are not going to get that. They're going to get a very bleakly funny adaptation of the Dostoevsky novel, which marries Terry Gilliam's Brazil with the films of the Finnish director Aki Kaurismäki. Jesse Eisenberg plays the double of the title. It's kind of dark, it's delirious. It's got a whole cavalcade of great cameos, including Chris Morris. And again, when I saw it, it had loads of walkouts. People that like it, love it. People that hate it. And I think that good films often should be divisive.
Jason, we're going to have to leave it there. Lots of sort of musical tips inside the movie Look Ahead as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Jason Wood, Programming Director of Curzon Cinemas. I kind of want to go straight to the movies now. I want to walk straight out of here after we finished, obviously, with everybody else and kind of get, well, possibly, certainly get all is by my side. I'm intrigued by that. Sounds great.
It's great.
We are doing the 2014 look ahead here on The Culture Show. You heard from Jason Wood. I'm also joined by Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, and Simon Prosser, publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to hear about TV Land from Lisa Campbell.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And we're almost ready to start the second segment of our 2014 look ahead here on The Culture Show. Welcome back to it. I'm now joined by Lisa Campbell. Well, I'm joined all at the same time by everybody. Everyone's free to not necessarily interrupt, but I think
you can interrupt.
I always like it that Lisa asked much better questions than I did to Jason. It's good. It makes my heart just sit back here. I've just got a script in front of me. I'll just let it go for itself. Lisa Campbell is editor of Broadcast magazine, and last year she gazed into a crystal ball. And she's going to do the same this year. Do we have a clip of what Lisa loved this time last year? I think we do.
House of Cards is the really big one. I mean, huge. £100 million budget for 26 episodes. So this is on Netflix, so this is available globally. And it's their first big commission. It's a 13 one-hour drama. It's a political thriller starring Kevin Spacey, and it's directed by David Fincher. So it is beautiful, slick, very expensive, a sort of dark West Wing, really. There's a French brothel drama, which is doing very well at the moment in France, which apparently is the new Denmark. So we should watch out for more French drama.
France is the new Denmark. This is so going to ask you, what's the new Denmark?
Yeah,
it's come so early.
I know. Okay. Pretty
impressed with that. I wish we could add some sound effects in, some ding ding ding, some kind of fruit machine sound effects. Lisa Campbell hit pay dirt with her predictions for 2013.
Yeah, although I think with House of Cards, even I was quite shocked at how Netflix just took off really on the back of that first original commission that it did. I mean, it sort of went from, you know, maybe film fans and enjoyed Netflix to suddenly everybody's talking about Netflix, and the TV industry are obsessed with Netflix. I mean, they really think that, you know, they're missing a trick by not having more of their stuff online.
And maybe we'll tackle that head of the Hydra first then, the distributors that are becoming program makers. Is that's set to sort of set the pace, presumably, for 2014 and for the foreseeable future?
It is, and it's actually seen the BBC actually adopting some of that strategy, and it's now saying that going forward it's going to be using the BBC iPlayer as the gateway, as the front door to the BBC. So they're going to be premiering a lot of comedies, for example, on the iPlayer, especially as, you know, younger audiences are sort of tending to go there first. So, you know, I think they're recognising they're a bit behind, and there is a lot of competition, and Netflix is commissioning more and more. So, yeah, interesting times ahead.
France is the new Denmark.
Yeah.
What's the new France? Everything has to be a new something, right? Yeah. Maybe it's not. Maybe France is still the new France.
France is still up there, actually, this year. I mean, the drama that I referred to last year was Maison Close, which is this very opulent drama set in a Parisian brothel. That's back for a second series. And HBO were so impressed with the show that they are developing an English language remake. And it's all part of Canal Plus is trying to be the sort of French equivalent of HBO, the big US channel. And it's the people that made that, the production company, is also behind The Returned, which was the first subtitled French drama to appear on Channel 4 in, you know, well, years. I don't think they've actually done one before. And it was huge in France. It was actually the biggest ever original series to run on that channel. And it's back for a second series, so we'll see that in 2014. I mean, that was a fantastic, you know, original drama, a sort of supernatural, but touched on universal themes, I think, really, of death, how people cope with grief, a sort of mother-daughter relationship. Really eerie, beautifully filmed, amazing soundtrack by Mogwai. It was, I think, left some fans disappointed on the very last episode, because it was so intriguing and we were sort of hoping all these mysteries would be, you know, solved in some way, but they absolutely weren't. And I mean, people took to Facebook to complain in numbers
to
about
it. To voice their displeasure, a bit of a limp ending.
This feels so French. I mean, it's surreal, and it's philosophy, surreality, beautiful, lots of nudity. It's kind of only the French can do it, and it's so it would seem wrong if you didn't also have the language to go with it. I mean, I think the second series is going to be really interesting. I think there's going to be quite a noise around it, because it's really shrouded in secrecy. So the writer Fabrice Gobert has said that things will be revealed quite early on in the series to try and satisfy the people who are so annoyed
and
first
to grab
time.
People presumably an early audience.
But apparently even the cast don't know the storylines. They're keeping it, you know, really close to the wire in terms of production and what they find out is going to happen. So I think that was a fascinating one.
We called France the new Denmark, but I think we're going to go back to Denmark next time.
Back to Denmark.
Or are we going to Scotland? I'm so confused.
We are going back to Denmark, yes, which has, as I said, the bridge has been a phenomenal success. I mean, that's been adapted in France and in the States as well. So it takes place there on the Mexican border. And that's been recommissioned for a second series on Fox and is sort of going great guns over there. Interestingly, they became quite famous for the strong female roles in Borgen, which was the prime minister, the bridge with the female detective and the killing with the female detective. Now they're going back to the men to see, you know, what they've been up to. And they're looking at basically fraud, finance and family. So there's a couple of dramas coming up. One of them is called The Legacy, and that's set in the 60s. And it's about an artist mother and her four sons and sort of just how they deal with her fame and also the changing dynamic in the 60s and you know, just how life is changing for the family. You know, there's that Scandinavian sensibility around the look and feel of these dramas, you know, that you get from films and the sort of, Ibsen and that sort of very moody and dark and a sort of intensity. I think that's kind of struck a note really with audiences around the world, because it feels quite distinctive.
Nordic noir.
Yes, yeah.
This which was obviously a big which I mean, maybe it came originally from the literary trend in the early noughties, I mean, or late noughties, right?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, that's where I know that phrase best from. But one flowed naturally from the other. I think those television dramas are amazing. They're so brilliantly done.
I think it's interesting, the writer of The Killing, you know, his response to the killing coming to an end and people all around the world saying, you know, but we love it. And he said, well, yeah, it could go on to, you know, for 1,000 episodes, but they wouldn't be very good. And he said, television today is not about quality, only entertainment. TV stinks. When I started writing for television, it talked down to you. It was about, say, hospitals, good-looking doctors, you know the recipe. If something becomes a success, it gets too big for itself. It's very, very important to move on. Which I think is great, you know. So
that's,
I mean,
good.
This is
also a man with a sort of a bullet hole in his own foot there, but it's very gutsy stuff.
It is.
That's a sort of Danish attitude, I think. I wanted to ask you, Lisa, about Fleming. This is about Ian Fleming, the James Bond author. This is something I'm quite excited about for 2014. How has this come to the screen? Who's making that?
This is BBC America, and it's airing on Sky Atlantic here, but it's being sold by BBC Worldwide. So they've got high hopes for this because, they're putting this forward to the international buyers at BBC Showcase. And obviously, given the global interest in the Bond franchise, they're hoping that this will be picked up in hundreds of territories, I would imagine. So it stars Dominic Cooper as Fleming. And I mean, we know a little of his story in creating Bond, but this really goes into much more detail about the backstory. You've got the context of the war, and it really is a sort of historical drama, but a love story as well. But it's a very dysfunctional relationship between him and his wife. She's called Anne, and I think they call her Good Time Annie. She's really, you know, he's got a passion for life, a passion for other men. He's got a passion for other women. I mean, he is quite Bond-like in his character. And, you know, they are incredibly dysfunctional and also, you know, sort of quite pained searching for their identity behind closed doors. But to the rest of the world, you know, they're out there and they're incredible. And this is quite beautiful to look at. It feels very Bond-like, you know, when it opens. There's a chase down a mountain. I mean, you kind of fooled into thinking you are actually watching a Bond movie.
It's an interesting thing. Also, things about the creators of well-known characters seem to always are a sort of subgenre in themselves, aren't they? Mm. I guess people want to know the genesis of the characters that they love. There's always that slightly clunky expositional moment when there's a sort of biopic about the Doors or something, and suddenly he goes, well, hey, Jim, why don't we go do 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 do, and suddenly it's like, and there's always that moment, isn't there? It's like, well, God damn it, I'm going to write a novel about a spy. It's the only thing I've got to do all night. And then it sort of happens.
Yeah.
And where else are we going? There's a thing on our list called The Penny Dreadful, which kind of the name attracts me to that.
Well, Penny Dreadful was the type of British fiction in the 19th century, usually lurid stories that cost a penny. And this is a drama series that is coming up. And actually, we know relatively little about it. It's described as a psychosexual horror TV series, and it's created for for Showtime.
After Watershed, I hope.
I know, exactly. It's created by John Logan, and it's executive produced by John Logan and Sam Mendes. And it sort of weaves together the origins of the literary horror characters. So we get, you know, Victor Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster, Dorian Gray, Count Dracula. It's got a pretty stellar cast attached to it so far. So Timothy Dalton is in it, another Bond, and Josh Hartnett is in that as well. I think just because of the names attached to this, there are sort of really high hopes that it's, you know, it's high budget, big names, and obviously incredible characters at its heart.
It's a compendium of horror movie stalwarts. And we've got a very quick clip which we're going to play.
I believe in curses. I believe in demons. I believe in monsters. Do you?
That sounds like winter viewing to me, right? Yeah. This sort of gothic kind of, what did you call it? Psychosexual horror.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. Simon Prosser says publish. But also points out that it should only be shown after the watershed.
Mm. Does that exist anymore?
The watershed?
Is there a watershed?
I don't even know, actually.
There is, yeah.
Is it 9 o'clock still?
It is, yeah.
Right.
Mm. Okay. Here we go. Mm. We'll write that down. Thank you very much, Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcasts, for our 2014 look ahead in terms of TV. Lots to get our teeth into on the small screen there. We're going to break very quickly for another track. This is new from the new Denmark, France. They're called La Femme, and this is Baby Doll, Chuck Berry.
Oh, baby doll. I'm not afraid to die.
and I quite like the sound of that. That is coming up in 2014. It's La Femme, a new band from France. The song is called Baby Doll Chuck Berry. The record is called Psychotropical Berlin. Sounds like something on Lisa Campbell's essential viewing list.
Absolutely.
I kind of like the whimsical nature of that. A little bit of driving, craft-worky kind of synths.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's great.
And you are tuned in to a special culture show here on Monocle 24, looking ahead to film, music and books in 2014. More to come. We're going to take a very short break. We're going to be back with Simon Prosser from Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. Stay tuned.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal. For everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. So far, we've picked our way through some film, TV and music for the year ahead. And now we turn to this year's new guest. Simon Prosser is publishing director at Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, friend of the Culture Show, hero of the hardback, prince of the paperback and a wise bookworm indeed.
I must come here more often.
I had to make the sound of me rustling the paper because that was in the script. That was good, wasn't it?
Very good.
Hero of the hardback.
Love it.
Yeah.
I can die a happy man.
Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
This sort of January day and looking into your... I don't know whether you've got a crystal ball or a snow globe.
Snow globe.
Yeah,
snow absolutely.
Globe. What's inside the snow globe?
I'm heading north as well to Scandinavia.
Okay, is that where we're going?
We're going to Scandinavia nice. Again, like many
Are we going Nordic noir or are we going to happier climes?
I wouldn't call them entirely happier, but it's certainly not noir, but it's, I think, the most important and exciting writer to come along from anywhere in the last couple of years. And that's Karl Ove Knausgård. Mm-hmm. And he's an extraordinary writer who's just beginning to be translated all over the world, having been a total sensation in Norway, where he's from, and in Sweden, where he lives. And he is writing, it's an incredible project. It's a 6-book novel, I guess you would call it. It's a novel, but it's in 6 parts, each of which is a book.
And they're big books.
Yeah, they're pretty big. And and you might call them memoir. It's very, they're published as fiction, but they're really books about his life, about growing up. And his great achievement, I think, is to find a way of writing about everyday life, the life we all lead, in a way that doesn't stint on detail. So you could have pages and pages of him going out as a 15-year-old to try and, you know, buy beer, literally 40 pages. But it's not boring. It's astonishing what he's done. It sort of re-enchants or reimagines the texture of our everyday lives. And instead of saying, that's the boring stuff, let's cut it out, he says, let's put that in. That's the real stuff. And it's kind of magical what he does. And once you get into it, it's completely addictive. It's addictive in the way, you know, Borgen is addictive, or whereas Danish miniseries are.
Is it's there amazing. Anything to be learned from that? I wanted to ask, all of you actually, whether you see the way that things are written. The Booker Prize winner last year, Ellen the Catton, the Luminaries, she said that she was inspired by long form TV, like the Swedish crime dramas that we've come to love, and the way that things end on a cliffhanger and there's a rhythm to them. Have you found that with the stuff that you've been reading for 2014, Simon?
Yeah, a little bit, and it's very interesting to me the number of writers I know who have been either writing for or pitching for doing HBO series, especially HBO.
Yeah.
That seems to be the holy grail. And it's a lot of, you know, very, very well-known people have, you know, been you know, working with them. Some of the projects have got somewhere, some haven't. But yeah, it's certainly an ambition. And I think actually if people ask me what my biggest worry about whether people read books anymore, will they continue reading? One big worry I have had, I feel okay about it today, but is that actually
the perfect, really well done, long form box set TV series gives you a lot of the same satisfactions.
Right.
I feel encouraged about it because
the subtlety, the nuance of the character and the plot and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
It's a very strange situation we're in when television's become so long form, 24 hours, you know, contained in a box set, for example.
Yeah,
that is how long it might take to read a book of the similar length.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But actually, I think if you love those box sets, you're probably also going to be even more of a lover of novels when you discover them, go back to them, whatever. I think they're very similar forms in some ways, and the best of them are. Really, they cross for
sure.
You're
getting that depth of character in you know series like Breaking Bad that you get from books, and I think that's unusual, isn't it? For TV, it's a bit normally more surface and a bit more smack him in the face with a plot and stuff. You know?
Yeah. I guess it's a sort of two way street as well. Plotting from television comes into novels, and the subtlety of novels goes into television writing, perhaps.
Yeah,
we've got something new now. You've brought this one in. It's a very handsome, sort of deco-ish.
Yeah, completely differently because he's a friend of Monocle. This is a very deco-ish cover for a new book by Alain de Botton, who's probably been on this show, actually.
Once or twice. Yeah, for sure.
And it's a book called The News, a User's Manual, and it's a book that came out originally of a month he spent working actually at the BBC, and he was a writer in residence there. And and while he was there and afterwards started thinking a lot about the news and what it means and how it's the stuff that surrounds us. We wake up every morning and check our iPhones or whatever device we have to find out what the news is. We periodically check it all the day. Some of us are quite obsessed by it. I guess the whole project of the Renaissance was that we all should know everything. You know, we should have perfect knowledge. We now live in a world where that, it's almost the case, in theory. In fact, what happens is you end up feeling often, Alain would say, and I would agree, feeling quite stupid. You have all this information, but you don't know how to use it, what to do with it, how to interpret it. So it can be very counterproductive, actually, our obsession with the news.
You become a sort of jack of all trades and a master of none, in a way. Well, yeah. I wonder what his prescriptions are. Does he think that you should maybe go on a news diet?
Yeah, there are many prescriptions in this book, a lot of them very interesting. So I'll just take one example. So one part of news is celebrity news. So rather than saying, actually, that's all rubbish, we should have no celebrities, what Alain would say is, well, actually in Greece and, you know, ancient Greece or ancient Rome, we did have celebrities. It's just that they were valued for things that ultimately were kind of good for us, if you like. So, you know,
like fighting in the nude.
Honour, valour, fighting in the nude, that kind of thing. You know. Sprinting.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever
we're
going to
try and think of some of the original Olympic sports.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing, I guess, rationing your sort of news input is kind of like not a bad thing to do. Sometimes it can be very saddening watching the news, presumably, or listening to it.
It can be very saddening. And I think he would highly recommend that we occasionally have news breaks and go off and sit in solitude and philosophically contemplate. And that's a very good thing to do. But more kind of extensively in the book, what he's arguing for is that it's a different kind of news, that, you know, we still have the news, but it's presented in ways that are more helpful and consoling to us.
And that's new from Alain de Botton, Simon. What's the title of the book?
It's called The News, A User's Manual, out in February.
Nice. And it's is it going to be, is that its first imprint in its handsome sort of deco cover?
Absolutely. But it will be. And is. This is just a very early copy.
We're lucky to lay our eyes on that. The other thing I've got on my list is short the new long? Short form fiction is making a comeback in 2014.
This is something I've been thinking about a lot. I love short form fiction and non-fiction, actually, essays. But it's just one of the truisms of publishing that it's almost impossible to publish short things. People don't really like buying them, we hear. In fact, I wonder how true that is. And also, I wonder whether there's been a cultural shift, such as we periodically have, where for all sorts of reasons we might see more attention put on the short form. Mm. And I'll give a few examples. One is that Lydia Davis won the Man Booker International Prize last year. She's not just a short story writer, she's a micro story writer. Some of her stories are literally two lines long. She's brilliant. I think she's a completely wonderful writer, but you know, one might have said she's someone who's very off the mainstream, and that's put a right into the mainstream in a very, very good way that we're delighted about, those of us who love that kind of work. And then Alice Munro won the Nobel, another short story writer. And more recently, just from personal experience, a little short story I published by Zadie Smith that had been in the New Yorker, published as a tiny hardback. Waterstones made the book of the month. That's a great vote of confidence by the major retailer here in short form fiction. So I've been thinking lots about that and the pleasures that it gives you and the way that it may be in the way that when you read less, you have to read more intensely, that actually the beauty of enjoying the short form is that you're reading more into less, you're giving it more time, it gives you more back. So I'm very interested in the short form, and I think that March will be very interesting this year because Lydia Davis has a new collection out, Can't and Won't, and also Laurie Moore has a collection out as well, so another great short form writer. And indeed, if you give me a few seconds, I could read some lines that would.
Yeah, let's
convince
have. We
you.
Can't really. Yeah. We can't really finish, without having some something from one of these collections. So, what are you going to read for us?
Okay, what I'm going to do is just read the beginnings of a couple of stories by Laurie Moore, just so that people can, because I'm sure they'll get anyone listening will get as much from these lines as they would from pages and pages of.
Katie, who's producing this, I think your voice is something that she thinks is a great sort of national living treasure. I would just like to say to her listeners, has a Cheshire Cat grin behind the glass.
Oh,
it's a good thing.
I'll try. Okay, story one from Laurie Moore. This is the first line. Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. Good, right?
That's very good.
Really good. Well, try story four. The day following Michael Jackson's death, I was constructing my own memorial for him. And I'm hooked.
So
already.
I wonder how. I think it's we need brilliant. One more. Let's have one more.
Okay, I'll give you one more. There are only eight in the book, but this is another one. She's very, very good at first lines. Let's try. The night Robin Ross was dying in the hospital, I was waiting for a man to come and pick me up.
They're really good, aren't they? I really want to dive into those.
So.
This is a bit of a simple pimple question for you, Simon, but I'm always intrigued as to how much you need to give a transcript before you hook, whether you it's two pages and you can tell from that or however it works.
I think, I mean, she is so good, you can tell from that line. And I bet if you carried on for a few lines, you'd think, yes, I absolutely know. So, but that's rare with most people.
One of my favourite lines is High Rise by J.G. Ballard. I think the opening line is something like, as Dr. Lang finished the remains of the dog, he relaxed and thought about the took the week in retrospect. I just love the idea of him.
Ben Wheatley's making that as a film.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
The other legendary opening line, which often people say is the best ever, is, and I won't get it quite right, but it's Anthony Burgess's Earthly Powers. As I was lying in bed with my catamite when the bishop rang the bell or something.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely attention grabbing.
I love those ones. I remember a book of science fiction short stories, like an octopus book of science fiction short stories when I was a boy, and thought... like the best opening line was the last man in the world sat alone in a room and there was a knock at the door. It's so good.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. It's probably like the one that you probably get taught how to do something better than that.
I'd sign him up.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Right? Yeah. We've got to leave it there. I'd like to thank my guest, Simon Prosser, publishing director at Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, and Jason Wood, director of programming at Curzon Cinemas. Thank you all for joining me on the Culture Show. And that's it for this week. And don't forget to tune in next week, though, for a more regular show. We don't quite know what's coming up, but we should thank Casey behind the glass, awed into silence by Simon Prosser's readings there at the end. And to end this show, this is something worth banking on for 2014. She's called Banks. She's produced by a new guy as well called Sohn, who's a Londoner based in Vienna. The track is called Waiting Game. Thank you to all my guests and thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
I'm thinking it over. The way you make me feel all sexy, but it's causing me shame. I wanna lean on your shoulder. I wish I was alive, but I don't wanna cause any pain. And if I'm feeling like I'm evil, we got nothing to gain. We're both on a stage. Don't tell me listen to your song because it isn't the same. I don't wanna say the line. Scared of even thinking about where we're